The Sunstone Theological Society presents Mormon Women's Sexuality, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
And promptly this evening, so that we'll have plenty of time for all five panelists and for plenty of discussion in the end. I would like to announce that this session is being recorded and that tapes will be available shortly after the session if you wish a copy. Also, printed in your program is Alan Whitesides giving opening prayer. He is here. Good. Alan, would you give our opening prayer at this point, and then we'll commence with the rest of the evening.
Our Father in heaven, at this time we give thee thanks for the many blessings we have. We're thankful to be able to meet together in an environment like this and to discuss freely some of the questions on our minds and some of the faith-promoting experiences, as well as some of the problems that we face as Latter-day Saints and people affiliated with the Church. And Father, we ask thee, especially tonight, to bless these women, that they will speak what represents their feelings and do it in the best way that they know how, that it might reflect the best, their best selves. Father, we ask as recipients of what they're to say that we might listen with understanding, that we might be as open as we know how to be. We ask for these blessings in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
The idea for this panel was conceived exactly 1 year ago at the banquet ending Sunstone Symposium. Debbie Christensen and I were seated at the same table, and as we discussed the issues of the symposium as well as things of interest to us, we decided that it was time to look at women's sexuality from many points of view. And so through this last year's gestation period, we have met a couple of times, and I have talked to all of these women therapists and pulled together a number of topics that we would like to discuss with you tonight. It seemed natural to me to pick women therapists who had a number of years' experience working with Mormon women as panelists. We have purposely not chosen to have any person present their individual personal experience or point of view because we wanted a broader overview of women's experience in many categories. I wanted to be able to find some way, without conducting a several-year-long research project, to find what may be typical experience of many women in the church. I and the other panelists helped me form the topics, and we will discuss five specific topics, and each of us will have one this evening. We will discuss married women's experience, single women's experience, the experience of sexually abused women, the experience of women who have had affairs, and gay women in the church. I realize in selecting this panel of women therapists that we have also created several biases and holes in our perspective, if you might say. You will notice there are no males among us, even though I think that's totally legitimate for men to comment upon their view of women's sexuality. We chose only women. All of us are also fairly well-educated, white, middle-income women who have lived along the Wasatch Front over the last decade. So we can, from our own experience and in seeing women clients in the same area, only give our views and impressions from this group of women, which incidentally is reflected in yourselves. I also realize that in selecting only therapists as panelists, that we may combine to give a collective view of issues and conflicts and weaknesses rather than strengths. But I believe that all of the women here basically are healthy women who have lives other than therapy and have a life-affirming stance. And so I believe that we will be able to reflect both sides of that question. In general, the purpose this evening of our remarks is to understand our sexual nature and the sexual practices that we engage in. We do not seek to recommend practice or policy. And since this is an initial search for the general topography of Mormon women's sexual experience throughout their lives, I believe that the order of the evening is to describe things that happen, express ways of feeling, and to understand issues and conflicts that we all face. Let me introduce each person in order of appearance, and we'll go in this direction. I am Mary Beth Raines. I am discussing, I'm not only your moderator and the general introducer, but I'm also discussing single women's experience. I hold two master's degrees, one in family relationships from Brigham Young University and one in social work from the University of Utah. I have been a practicing therapist for the last 10 years, and I'm licensed as both a clinical social worker and a licensed marriage and family therapist. I'm currently in private practice full-time, which I enjoy immensely. When I can summon up the motivation, I occasionally write articles or do research on topics of interest to me in Mormon culture. I am married, although I have spent approximately half of my adult life single. I have three teenage children, two daughters, Terry and Sarah, and a son, Nathan. I also have eight stepchildren whom I consider as friends. Debbie Christensen, to my right, will discuss the experience of women who have been sexually abused. She has a PhD from the University of Utah in clinical psychology. Clinical counseling. I know at the U of U that makes a big difference. I'm not sure it makes a big difference to us, Debbie. she is currently employed at the Utah Valley Medical Center in the Eating Disorders Clinic. She has also been employed at the Intermountain Sexual Abuse Treatment Center and LDS Social Services, where she has worked with children who have been sexually abused, adult women who have been abused as children, mothers of abuse victims, and perpetrators. She is married and has five children. Frieda Stewart, whose last name is misspelled in your program, it is S-T-U-A-R-T, will present her impressions and some research findings on married women's experience. She holds a doctorate in social work from the University of Utah. She's a licensed social worker and an accredited sex therapist. She is co-director of the Sex and Marital Therapy Clinic at the University of Utah Health Sciences Center. She has worked with couples in sex and marital therapy for over 15 years. Her dissertation topic was in the area of inhibited sexual response of women. She is also married and has three sons, who I think are mostly grown, right? Barbara Wheeler will discuss women who have had affairs or who are having affairs. We had originally wanted to discuss the larger topic of sexual guilt, or the experiences of women who go beyond their own sexual or moral codes and values in sexual terms. But since guilt occurs in each panelist category, Barbara volunteered to narrow the topic. She is in private practice in Salt Lake City as a social worker. She holds a doctorate in social work, and she also teaches full-time in the social work department at BYU. She does research on women's issues and has written on psychotherapeutic approaches to working with women in therapy. She is married, has three grown children, loves to play tennis, ski, and sit on a rock. Her meditation approach. Karen Fisher, our last panelist, will discuss the experiences of gay women in the church. She is a native Utahn who has spent 16 of her adult years living in the San Francisco Bay Area. She was affiliated with the University of Utah for 10 years, where she was director of the Center of Academic Advising and served on various committees, including the Liberal Education Council Committee for the Future of the University, and is chairperson for the President's Task Force on Career Mobility for Women. Karen has taught many classes focused on women's growth and development and has been a frequent speaker for conferences and workshops for women. She is currently co-director of the Mill Creek Counseling Center, where her private practice is focused primarily on marriage and family counseling and issues relating to personal growth and relationship enhancement. Karen has three children, a son Jeff, a son Kelly, and a daughter Lisa. As both moderator and panelists, I will change hats midstream in my presentation. First, I would like to introduce the general issues of Mormon women's sexuality, that is, issues that occur for many of us, and then move to the particular concerns of single women. Sexuality, I believe, is a general quality of being, one aspect of our total self that is with us from birth to death and is indivisible from the rest of our soul. In subtle ways, in the ways we move our head, in the way we form words, in the way we move our total bodies, that quality of sexuality and sensuality exudes and moves from us. And even though we may at times experience a split, it stills with us all of the time. For those of us who feel that we are separated, or that sexuality and our sexual organs are a separate part of our being, I believe that we essentially are confronted with an issue of a split that really isn't there. This issue is a confusion of being and doing, a lack of discrimination between inner intrinsic qualities and a being that we do not create. In other words, we have an inner quality of sexuality, an inner quality in our being that we don't create but simply is and that we can foster and have grow, and an external action that we can make choices about, that we can choose to behave in certain ways or not behave in certain ways. And that I believe many times in the church we confuse those two things. Our sexuality is our sexual action for many people. And so if you're not doing anything, you are not sexual. And I think that's an artificial split, that we are sexual all of the time, and that then we still have choices about sexual action or not. I think this occurs because we belong to a church which has, over the last century and a half, emerged into a very practical, action-oriented organization. Our views of ourselves as good or religious depends for many on how we are living the commandments. Indeed, we are told that how we live the commandments determines how we form a relationship with God and whether He will allow the Holy Spirit to reside with us. In other words, our external action determines our access to our inner being. So we experience our sexuality as split from our spirituality, and that the two are only brought into congruence in very narrowly defined terms. The emphasis is primarily on what we do and not what we are. Actually, the emphasis is on what we are not to do. So that we learn from the pulpit that our sexuality and our feelings and urges are God-givens, but they are only experienced within strict behavioral codes. So I believe that we gradually learn that our sexuality, that inner quality of being, is judged by our outer activity of doing. And since the codes are strong and the consequences are great, sexual action or non-action goes to the core of our self-worth for most Mormon men and women. We believe we are sexual or not sexual according to what we have done or not done, not about what we are. Another issue, I think, is that many times we don't know what the issues are. As we were forming this panel and talking about how to divide it up and who was going to say what, there was some kind of discussion about, well, what are the issues? Or are we sure we're going to hit all the right topics? Or, you know, if I say this, is that going to resonate with people in the audience? And so, in some ways, we have so much not talked about sexuality and that inner quality of being that we don't know what to talk about. And so I must tell you that this evening's panel is kind of like a stab in the dark to pick out the topics that may be of importance. Well, as you may guess, no discussion of sexuality in Mormon culture is complete without a discussion of guilt. It certainly won't be the focus of the evening, but I must mention it. Harold Christensen, who is a sociologist, now emeritus from Purdue University, has conducted 3 decades of research on the premarital sexual behavior of college students in 3 cultures, Mormon, Midwestern, and Danish. And after 3 studies over 3 decades, he concludes that Mormons experience more guilt for less variation from their norms than any other culture. I will add that to Freda Stewart's comment to me of 5 or 6 years ago. She said to me, I don't think anybody gets to the age of 18 without feeling somewhat uncomfortable about some sexual experience. So if you add Harold Christensen and Freda Stewart's remarks together, we are all in a high probable, we're in a high risk group, I guess is what you call it. Yes, we're in a high risk group for guilt, and we don't have a lot of ways to resolve that within ourselves. Another issue that I think occurs for many Mormons with their sexuality is that fully developed sexuality within a person occurs within the whole body. Even though someone once said that the largest sexual organ is the mind, it still occurs within our whole body. We experience it in a totality. And if we experience our spirituality and our sexuality as split, we many times disidentify with our bodies, and so that we will speak of parts of our body, particularly our private parts, as separate from ourselves. We would say, my breasts, or as I recall one client saying, do these things grow older when grow bigger when I get older? In some sense, seeing it as a separate part of herself than of the self. Let me give you just semantically that difference. A person who would disidentify with her body would say, these are my breasts, or these are my hands, or this hair never seems to fit quite right, and, you know, should I scrunch it up a little more? Versus a person who identifies with their body would say, I move and I enjoy the feeling as I sit and I dance and I run. And so all the statements are in terms of I am, and that all of the self is experienced as an integrated self versus a split self, that where you have body as object. My breasts are two objects that I have, and I may or may not like them, or I may not like the size of them, but in fact I have them and I have to deal with them somehow. Actually, that has been an issue. Anyway. Even though there is that tightly constructed view, we don't have a fully developed view and sometimes disidentify with our bodies in Mormon culture, I think it leaks through in wonderful ways at times. If you really will watch a church, some women know how to dress wonderfully and know how to move wonderfully, and it just kind of exudes out of them that you know they are very sexual beings, even though they are dressed up in their Sunday best. So even though we don't have any official models for an integration of sexuality and spirituality, you might just notice at church next Sunday. More specifically speaking in terms of women's sexuality, I think some important issue for women are that for many women, their sexuality is defined by men in two ways. The first is that church authorities will say what one is, how one's sexual behavior is to be conducted, how one's body is to be used, and what one can do in every instance and what one cannot do. And our sexual feelings about ourselves and what we are is reflected by my men's reaction to us. We are more sexual, for instance, if men respond to our flirting or ask us out or ask us, you know, to marry them. We are not asexual if that none of that happens or we can't figure out how to do it. It's such an inextricably subtle game that we don't know how to do it. And that there are important ways in which that gets played out in terms of that reaction. If you'll notice, for Mormon women who know how to combine that righteous, sweet spirit, good girl, and sexual attractiveness somehow, there's a rather narrow band of acceptability. If you are too bland, or too overweight, or your hair's not attractive enough, or you have too much of a sweet spirit but nothing else, then you're too cold. So it's like you don't connect in some way. If, however, you dress too sensuously, I mean, too many scarves and too many long earrings and too much moving and swaying as you move in and out, then you're too hot, and that doesn't quite fit either. And so there's this narrow band in which it's okay or not okay, and women know kind of what all the subtleties are, and how we know, of course, is looking at each other and looking at how men look at women. But in any case, I think that's a really strong cultural issue for all of us, and it creates a sense of self, our identification with ourselves as sexual or non-sexual, depending on how it's reflected in the outside world. We also don't have a word for femaleness in Mormon culture. We call it femininity, but we don't have a broader concept of femaleness. And so there are some models, but I think that they are limited, unfortunately. We'll have to hurry through some of the other part of this. Another issue, I think, for women's sexuality in the church, or particularly Mormon culture, is in the area of bishops' interviews and courts. They only occur with men. In a time when a woman is feeling guilty or confused or shamed or abused, she has no women available to her to talk with, to receive support, to make judgments or decisions. They are only made by men. And I know that there are very many loving, understanding men in the church. But in some way, it's like an obstetrician who is male. He will never have a baby. And there are some things that you really need support from the inside, and need a sense of same sex or same gender to have a sense of support with that. I was told of one example today of a bishop in Boston, or stake president in Boston, who, when they investigated women who were being violently abused in their stake, that he appointed a counselor in the Relief Society to talk and be available specifically to women who are being violently and sexually abused. And in that sense, women do have available to them in that stake another woman who they can talk to and express that confusion and sort it all out. I wish I could. I have like five more issues that I could talk about, but I simply don't have time, so I'll move on to the issue of single women. And so if others occur to you, please bring it up during the discussion period. About 30% of the adult population of the church is single. That's 18 years and older. And according to a Church News article in 1983, five times as many women are active in the church as men. So if you combine those two statistics with a church membership total of over 6 million people, you have more than 1.5 million single adult women in the church who are trying to find out something about their sexuality. I don't know that it's always a central focus in their lives, but in fact, that's an issue. I think it is one of the most difficult conundrums in the church. I think it is hard to estimate the pain of that long struggle because we simply don't talk about it. How do we, as single women, if we are single, I'm going to use the we in the personal form so to not put us out there, how do we, as single women, learn the wonder of sensuality, the gifts of womanly grace, of passion? And many women will describe themselves as feeling neuter. And one woman friend said, thank God for vicarious experience. But vicarious experience isn't real experience. It's not integrated experience. And I think that is a lifelong struggle for many women who either never marry or never are sexually experienced. Of course, one of the biggest questions of the evening, I'm sure, that you want to ask is, what do single women really do? You know, forget the talk about these inner qualities and so on. What do women do? I believe that women fall into generally three categories, and of course they're my construction, so you may disagree. I believe there are large groups of women or large number of women who have no sexual experience, who either don't date or don't understand that ineffable process of connecting with men and finding about themselves and their body, that they have none, and they stand on the outside looking in, and that there is a lot of deprivation and loneliness in that search for who am I and what is my body and what is my sexuality. I believe there is also another group of women who do date, who interact with men fairly freely, who interact with other women fairly freely, who have partial sexual experience in the sense that they try to figure out what that narrow line of okay and not okay is. And I've heard endless discussion about, is it right down to here, or is it above the neck, or is French kissing okay or not okay, or is everything okay except in the bikini area, or, you know. And each person, you know, kind of is real confused about that. And I think those women, even though they really experience a lot of sexual feeling and their bodies becoming more alive, are caught between the polarities of confusion and guilt. And then sexual interest. I'll put confusion and guilt on one side and sexual interest and expression and feeling on the other side. And I'm not just talking about sexual expression in terms of sexual feelings. I'm talking about the sense of loving and being nurtured and that kind of interaction also. I have one woman friend who's 35 and has never been married, and I think from her description has stayed above here anyway. But she's also a person who has discovered, as many women do as they move into their 30s and 40s, that naturally our biology keeps ticking. And in this case, it could be in a positively direction, which is sexual feelings come more alive, more spontaneously. We find ourselves having dreams and waking up in the morning and sitting in church, and spontaneously a fantasy will come to our mind of somebody sitting, well, maybe even the bishop, you know. And all of a sudden, you know, your pelvic area feels really warm and wonderful and uncomfortable, and what do you do with that when you're trying to listen during the sacrament? And or sitting next to someone or not knowing what to say. And I've heard many women get really confused about like that. What am I doing wrong? And again, it's the confusion of being and doing. It is simply something that's happening as we grow older. And for many women, that really occurs unless it's blocked or doesn't happen somehow. And anyway, this woman friend who's over 35 has certainly experienced this for many years and really likes it a lot. And so But she's also really strict with herself in terms of what she allows herself to do or not. And she really, I mean, I actually, her descriptions of how she really enjoys kissing is better than some women's description of sexual intercourse. But she really experiences herself sexually and sensually and says she knows consciously that she goes to church dressed up a certain way and that she gets certain kinds of reactions and that she acts certain ways. And yet the frustration and the sense of loneliness and the sense of just going to a certain place and stopping is so strong that she feels like literally biting fingernails a lot. By the way, if anybody wants your name and phone number, they can ask me afterwards. I told her I'd say that. Actually, I think of two or three people that fit in that category. There's also a group of women who have been married or now divorced and have not only been sexually experienced in marriage but really enjoyed it. Women who were sexually active before they joined the church, or women who choose over time and are long-term single, and I'm mostly talking about long-term single women, not, you know, just around 18 or 19 or so on, who choose to become sexually active and still try to figure out what's happening with the church part of their life. For these women, I think the split between their spirituality and what is okay and how they feel about the church, the split between their sexuality and the church becomes stronger, and the most likely outcome for many of those women is disaffiliation from the church. Harold Christensen found in his research among, these are younger kids, or younger people in college, that most who became sexually active and had sexual intercourse, about 75 to 80% left the church, left activity in the church, which does not mean that they left the church within them. There's still that struggle is what does it mean and what's my faith and what's my relationship to God. But in any case, they left activity in the church, and so the split became even stronger. The third issue, I believe, for women, single women, that is a long issue, is that for long-term, for women who are single throughout most of their adult lives and either never married or never remarry, they must go through by themselves a long rite of passage into adulthood. The rite of passage from a non-sexual being to a sexual being for most women is accomplished through the ceremony of marriage with a lot of excitement and fulfillment and looking forward to. Don't pretend to believe that all married women have wonderful experience with that, but at least it starts in an avenue of excitement and fulfillment. For single women who do not have the availability of sexual experience to them, who do not choose it or do not see it as a way possible while still keeping their spiritual self, they must find this rite of passage through pain, and they must eventually sometime decide to become an adult on their own. They have to catapult themselves into adulthood with no ceremony and with no support group. And the entry points, I believe, are so different. For women who have no sexual experience, many times it's deprivation and loneliness. For those women who are partially sexually experienced, I think the confusion and guilt sometimes become so great that they really have to look, what in the world is this all about? And what's my life going to be like if I never married? And is this worth it? And if I never get married, do I really want to live life without having sex? And those kinds of questions start the path, that rite of passage to adulthood, that transition from reliance on external authority for deciding who you are and what your moral conduct is to an inner authority within your own soul where you are your final judge and determiner of who you are, what your sexuality is, and how you make moral choices or ethical choices. For the women who are sexually experienced and sexually active and remain in the church and experience that incredible split, some really do disaffiliate, but others stay, and they are catapulted probably quicker than most, in that tension and separateness is so strong that they have to be pushed actively into questioning, who am I, what am I about, what am I on earth for, and how do I figure that all out? I believe it's a long time coming. I think most single women who never marry or are not married for a long time go through at least a 10 or 15 year questioning and wondering. I believe that there are certain points where we struggle and struggle for years. One, for instance, is masturbation. Do I not? It is a sexual experience available to me. What does that mean? Each woman I have worked with has come up with her own solution to that. But it is an excruciating, years-long struggle. But I must say in conclusion that those women who do it, those women who face themselves and say, I can't escape this, I won't disown my sexuality, and I won't disown my feelings about spirituality or God, or in many cases the church. Those women come out more mature than sometimes married women because they can't escape the dilemmas and they can't escape the issues. I'm not saying that married women do entirely either. I don't mean to imply that. I just know that it sometimes is easier to get caught up into issues of husbands and children and all of that. But when you're single, you can't escape that kind of questioning that happens over years long. And I must say, I applaud these women for their years-long effort at trying to figure out what their sexuality means when they're not given the context to do it in. Thank you.
I fear there's going to be a radical change in the atmosphere at this point. Sexual abuse is a serious dilemma that we face, and I don't know how to present it otherwise than to let you know that it's serious, and I know how serious it is, and this podium moves. I want to start my remarks with an awareness and let you know that I am aware that as I speak to you, I recognize that many of you have been sexually abused. Some of you may be perpetrators of sexual abuse. But although there are various statistics available, I think the most reliable ones are that 1 in 4 females are sexually abused before the age of 18. And so as I look at any group of people, I know that I am speaking to women who have been sexually abused, and I hope you'll be aware of that also. I also want to help you be aware that all of us, and to some extent, are wounded children. Maybe not through sexual abuse, but all of us were wounded during our childhood, and we were wounded by children who were wounded during their childhood. So we're talking about patterns that go on for years and generations. We are all wounded children of wounded children. As I talk about sexual abuse, I think you'll understand I have a focus on incest simply because I've worked with incest, not because I believe that that is the only form of sexual abuse. My focus will also be on women as victims and men as perpetrators, but I know that is also not the case. Many men are victims. The statistics on that are close to 10%. Many women are perpetrators of sexual abuse, and we don't have statistics on that. I will also talk mostly about father-daughter incest, and I think we all know that there is also incest from grandfathers, from siblings, and from various other places. So just that you understand, my focus isn't that that's what is and that's all that is, it's simply that that is what I do work with. As we talk about healing sexual abuse and the sexuality of women who have been sexually abused, I think it's important that we go back, and I want to remind you of the definition that Mary Beth gave of sexuality. In my words, it would be that sexuality is an awareness and acceptance of our wholeness, of all of us, that we are, that I am. And as a person, I am sexual. And as we heal victims of sexual abuse, we do not heal just their sexuality. We must see them as total females, and heal the total femaleness of that person who is a victim. To understand sexual abuse, I've chosen to use Finkelhor's conceptualization, which gives us 4 different aspects to understand where a person is wounded, how a person is wounded when they are sexually abused. And the first wound comes from their traumatic sexualization, comes from the fact that they experienced rewards and punishment from sexual gratification or sexual use far beyond their years that they could have any capacity of understanding what was happening to them. This results in a phobic reaction to sexual intimacy, or in the extreme, which would be promiscuity or successive short-term sexual relationships. I don't know what makes a difference in those 2 reactions to it, but I know that along that continuum, we have both reactions to that. And a confusion over their sexual identity, a confusion over sexual norms, an inability to understand what is normal. And you'll see this, I see this in children I work with who have been eroticized at an early age and continue to be erotically stimulated by things that other children don't have any focus on erotically. It just happens. But these children respond sexually to myriads of stimulation. One little girl was talking today about a little boy in her preschool who was playing with her and ended up on top of her, and she believed that he was trying to have sexual intercourse with her. And that's the conceptualizations that children have once they have experienced that too early. Stigmatization. The offender blames the child. There's secrecy in the family. The child then believes that they are stigmatized, that they are unique, that they are different. They feel guilt and shame over that difference and believe that they will always be different from others. I hear this stated in children as they say, "But I've been sexually abused," which is a statement that says to me, "So I am not like any other child, and don't expect me to be. I am unique. I am different. I have been sexually abused." A sense of betrayal. This depends largely on the extent to which the trust was originally built in the relationship. But with that sense of betrayal, it becomes difficult for anyone who has been abused in any way, particularly sexual abuse, to trust. Or we again get the extreme of over-dependencies or too much trusting, too much vulnerability in relationships. This becomes out... This comes out also, the betrayal leads to the great deal of anger that sexual abuse victims feel, and a sense of powerlessness. Anyone who has been sexually abused has had someone else invade their boundaries against their will in any way, and that sense of powerlessness can be most profound. As I work with victims of all of these, I find this one to be the most profound impact of sexual abuse. It's just what I see. I don't know that anybody would agree, but that's what I see. The powerlessness is reinforced in their attitude towards their gender as a whole. They see all women as victims, and they have a perception that they, as a woman, are a victim. They fear and they experience anxiety over their powerlessness in the world. Basically, all of us, to some extent, because we all have been victims at some point or have been wounded children, have experienced some of these feelings. Seems to me somewhat important as we deal with sexual abuse people that we get in touch with our own woundedness, our own victimizations, and in using that, we can understand the experiences of someone who has been sexually abused. To heal the sexually abused person, we heal the whole of the female, not simply the sexuality. It's vital that we look at it all. What would be important, I think, for us to do as a culture, as a people in a culture, would be to look at ways that we as Mormons, that we as a part of this culture, either contribute to the healing process or find that we are detrimental to that process. And as I've worked with this, I've seen significant impact from the culture on the victims that sometimes is not healing, but also significant impact that is very healing to children who have been sexually abused. The first one in the area of stigmatization, this one is one we have a difficult time dealing with, because as a culture we reward sameness, and yet we have 1 in 4 women who are not the same who have been sexually abused and feel difference. And we, in our rewarding of sameness, allow too little room for people to express their differentness. How often do we, as we sit in Relief Society, express difference? Don't we more often sit there and experience sameness? And sometimes we want to express, "That's not my experience. I don't agree with that. It's not what I know to be true." But we sit quietly because we know that as soon as we say that, we will then have the wrath, the anger, of those who are invested in sameness. seems that if we search to become a healing culture, we also must search to become a culture that can reward differences and to the extent that we now reward sameness. I didn't expect that. As we deal also with the stigmatization, I look at children differently, having worked with sexual abuse. And every time I see a group of primary children who come up on the stand to sing a little song, I think 1 in 4 have been sexually abused. That's my way my mind works right now. But the thing that pains me is how often we have them sing, "I'm so glad when Daddy comes home." And I'm thinking, not all of those children are. Some of those children are having very intense reactions to that expectation that they be able to stand on the stand and sing that song. We give no room to the children to be different either. The children are to be the same. They are to all experience those feelings because we have defined that as appropriate. And we give them no room to express that their feelings are different. I see that in primary classes too, as we teach to the fantasy of the idealized family, the patriarchal model, the father who loves and takes care and the mother who is submissive. When we teach this fantasy, how many of our children live that fantasy? Very few. The majority of our children live a reality quite different from that. And I think it would be very healing for those children if we would teach to the reality of the children that we teach rather than to the fantasy of what we want to believe is happening in their lives, because it's not. I have a lot more, and time is out almost. It's not, because I'm not going to let it be. The other issue that I really want to talk about is powerlessness. As women, most of us have experienced and hope at some point have kind of, in some way, come to grips with the fact that institutional power is denied to us. You've got victims who feel powerless who then have institutional power also denied to them. And it becomes very important for us as women to help women to experience personal power and to know that they can have that personal power in their lives. It becomes important as we realize that we're a society where we deal with sexually abused children that anger is appropriate. And we spend a lot of time telling our members that anger is not appropriate. I have women come to me and say, "I've been to the bishop," and one woman I was talking with just today, her daughter was a victim of satanic ritual abuse. She went to the bishop to tell him and explain some of the abuse to him, and the bishop said to her, "Well, we know we shouldn't dwell on these kinds of things." And she said, she came back to me in tears and said, "I know they don't understand, but I wish they knew they don't understand." The problem is they think they understand, and they don't understand. And she says, then she went on to say, "And I need to talk about this more than anybody ever will want to hear about it." And that's what she was finding out. We deny the reality of sexual abuse because we don't want to admit it, because it's hard, because we would rather pretend that it doesn't exist. We don't want to hear someone talk about it. But every time we do that, we are contributing to their sense of powerlessness. We must hear, we must listen, and we must gain a sense, or help them gain a sense, that they are powerful, that they are heard, that they can be heard, and that they can heal. Until we're ready to accept that reality, we cannot be a part of the healing process that we need so desperately. In conclusion, I'd like to go back. I know the stigmatization, the betrayal, and the powerless may seem to you not to be an inherent part of the sexuality of a woman who has been sexually abused, but it is vital that we begin to see ourselves as total females, and our sexuality is an expression of the power that we feel as women.
This is the end of Side 1.
Well, I will be number three to make a definition of sexuality. I think each of us is trying to abbreviate something that would probably warrant a few days' discussion. I think of sexuality as all of the feelings, thoughts, actions of being male or female. Living in bodies which are sexual, whether we wish them to be or not, we are born sexual beings. The behavioral expression of our sexual desires and urges is how we act with regard to our sexual feelings. As Mary Beth said earlier, we tend to be taught what not to do sexually. Tonight, I would like to talk about what married LDS women have been willing to share about what they do sexually. This may bore you. Really? It might. The reason it might is because there's going to be an awful lot of figures, but not those kind of figures, but numbers. I'm going to be talking a lot about numbers. We have asked LDS women to fill out a married women's questionnaire that has some very personal questions on it. And I think we offer a very personal thanks to all of those that comply. I think they will mirror the women in this room, for they are well-educated and very affluent and very interested in their religion. The average age woman that I'm talking about tonight is 41.1 year old. Her spouse is 42.2 years old. They've been married for an average of 17 years. We had 79 responses that we received before the symposium in time to do some computerized work, and I'll talk about these 79 women. This is the average woman of the 79. We received over 100 responses. We're still getting responses, and we sent out over 200 questionnaires, and that is, for those of you who are aware of the statistics of research, quite an unusual return on the high side. The highest level of education, 74 of the 79 women had at least some college education. 50 of the 79 women were college graduates or had even more advanced degrees. 46% of the women worked part-time. 17% worked full-time. So the total employment rate was 63%. The women did everything from clerical and sales to teaching. There were small business owners, administrators, and other professionals. The annual household income from all sources was $58,000. The range was from $15,000 to over $200,000. 69 of the 79 women were raised LDS. 100% of the women are currently practicing their religion. All of those that were not, we excluded from this at this point in time, though we are hoping to get responses from women of all religions or of no religion. Currently, these women attend, over 90% of these women attend church weekly. 81% of them feel that religion influenced their life in a very positive way when they were growing up, and 88% feel very positive about religion in their life today. 65 of the 79 women would marry the same man again. I consider that most unusual. 98% of these women, mind you, there's approximately 20% who would either not marry at all or would not, or who would not marry at all or would marry a different person, and yet 98% of these women are very committed to their marriages, and over 90% have very high trust in their spouse. 91% feel deep love for their spouse. Now, the next two statistics are also going to be very unusual. 80% of the women felt emotionally close to their husbands, and 77% felt still romantically in love with their husbands. I say that's most unusual because I think all of us up here as counselors would probably have some agreement in terms of thinking that a lack of emotional closeness and the lack of the continuation of romance are frequent complaints of women in terms of their disappointment in marriage. Would anybody think differently than that? So we're talking about a very unusual group of women who feel very satisfied with their relationships. The question was, how old were you the first time you had sexual intercourse? And the average age was 21.5 years. 19 out of 77 women, or 24%, had premarital sexual experiences, had premarital sexual intercourse. Let me make that more specific. That is considerably lower than the national average of 41% of women who have premarital sexual experiences. And now I'm talking about the woman who is 40 years old. If we are looking at the woman who is 20 or 21 or 25 years old, that figure escalates greatly. 5 out of the 78 women have had sexual relations with someone other than their husband while married to their husband. Again, according to the surveys that I have read, that 18% of 48-year-old women would have extramarital affairs. Barbara will talk about that next. It's projected that every other woman, or 50% of today's women, are having extramarital relationships. 5 of the 78 women, and when I shift, there were 79 questionnaires returned. If I give another number like 78 or 77 or 75, that's because there's missing data, and that some women did not answer the question. 5 of 78 women have been involved in sexual experiences with their own sex. 56% of the women masturbated during their younger years. Half of these responded rarely, but nevertheless, 56%. At some time or another during their childhood or teenage years, experience self-stimulation. 40% of the women still engage in self-stimulation, though the majority claim they rarely do. According to statistics of the 1970s, for the general population of adult regular churchgoers, of women who are around 40 years old, that statistic would be 51%. 16 of 77 women were sexually molested. That's 21% and conforms closely to Debbie's figure of 1 out of every 4 female children are sexually molested before the age of 18. 3 women reported they were raped. Seventy-one percent of women showed high affection toward their spouse. And over the last year, we ask, what would be the average number of times that the women engaged in sexual intercourse with their spouse? And the response was 1.7 times per week, not quite the 2 times per week average. That's the frequency of 40-year-olds in the general population.
They're doing work in church.
As you can tell, I'm the non-LDS panelist. . 80% of the women almost always accepted their husband's request to make love. 27% of the women had very low sexual desire. That probably is slightly above the projected figure for the average adult female population. There are not any statistics on sexual desire. They're only thoughts about it, but soon that will be coming out. However, 63% of the women maintained high sexual desire for their spouses. We listed a variety of common sexual practices, and we asked the women to please check those in which they participated with their husband. And the following is the information that was reported. 90% of the women were involved in close body contact with their spouse. Okay? Now that 10% is very significant because 98% of the women engaged in sexual intercourse. However, there seemed to be some distance. It's very interesting because it's a secret that I would like to know about. I think that there's more than one way to express being miffed at your husband, and that sounds like a very interesting idea. And if any of you out there could answer the question for me, please see me afterwards. Okay. There was body caressing 87% of the women. Their bodies were caressed, and they caressed in turn. 91% of the women experienced having their breasts fondled. 82% had their genitals caressed. At the time that Kinsey came out with his report, that was in the 1950s, and he found that 90% of the women experienced genital caress. So you can see there's some interesting discrepancy there. 83% of women caressed their spouse's genitals. 87% of women involved themselves in lip kissing, and 80% in French kissing. 87% engaged in having their breasts kissed. Genital kissing, genital sucking and licking, oral genital sex is a very controversial topic. According to the women who responded, 62% were receivers of oral genital sex, and 58% of the women were givers. This is less than in the general population, where 72% of the women are givers and 72% are receivers. Orgasm was experienced during 2/3 of the women's sexual encounters with their spouses. 10% of the women experienced no orgasm, and that's pretty much what happens in the general population. 43% of the women experienced orgasm 90% or more of the times of their sexual encounters. They experienced orgasm in different ways. 23% with self-stimulation, 63% with their spouse's manual stimulation, 32% of the women experienced orgasm with oral genital sex, 66% experienced orgasm with sexual intercourse, and 11% experienced orgasm with a vibrator. The median amount of time spent in love play was 15 minutes. Median is the middle point, meaning half above that they were involved in love play before having intercourse more than 15 minutes, and half of the women were involved in love play less than 15 minutes. That's right on with the typical figure for the general population. The median amount of time spent in sexual intercourse was 10 minutes, and once again, that's right on with the rest of the general population. It's very interesting how sex changes over time and sexual practices change over time. When Kinsey's study on the male came out, the average amount of time spent during sexual intercourse was 2 minutes or less. And Kinsey considered that a biological superiority. Because you see, in evolutionary times, the male had to deposit his sperm very fast and then flee because danger may be lurking around the next bush. Some 25 years later, Masters and Johnson identified premature ejaculation as a disorder of epidemiological proportion in this United States of America. And I think it's really delightful that, if you'll pardon a pun, men rose to the occasion, and the 2 minutes has turned into 10. After intercourse is over, 81% of the couples remain physically connected. 53% of the women say, "I love you." 54% talk with their spouses. 77% continue to hold. 45% continue to caress and fondle. 13% separate quickly. 54% wipe off. 35% wash. 25% go to sleep almost immediately. And 9% other, but they didn't tell us what it is. Overall, with this group of women, 21% had low satisfaction in their relationship with their husband. It's also very interesting that 21% of the women were molested. And I'm not making a one-to-one correlation, but just bringing that to your attention. 68% had high satisfaction, emotional satisfaction in their relationship. 20% felt there was conflict between their religious beliefs and their sexual practices. And I'd like to take one quick minute to end by letting the women speak for themselves. So I will quote from some of their comments and we'll cover both ends of the spectrum. Rather than experience sexual guilt, I learned to deny strong sexual urges. I sometimes feel, however irrational, that the sexual conflict, frustration, and unhappiness in our marriage is a divine and poetically just punishment for my sexual strayings before marriage. I worry about not fulfilling an important earthly experience during this lifetime. When I was raised, I got the impression that sex was for multiplying and replenishing the earth. Since no one seems very eager to explicitly discuss the issues, I still do not know what exactly is in harmony with the gospel. I find it difficult to consider an eternity of controversy over this part of our relationship. But on the other hand, sex with my husband is true intimacy. I feel our bodies are made for sexual enjoyment. Lovemaking has sometimes healed us spiritually. Sharing feelings with each other makes the best foreplay. I think that she spoke for every woman. Each time the sexual act occurs, you are saying to your mate, I love you, I need you, I choose you forever. Thank you.
I wasn't bored, Frida. I didn't see very many people dozing off out there. No one else was dozing off either. Mary Beth said that I was going to talk about extramarital affairs, and that's really not true. We call them extramarital affairs, but actually everybody ought to be having extramarital affairs. If you define affairs as interests, everybody ought to be reaching outside of their marriage and finding other interests and other relationships. So what we're really talking about tonight is extramarital sexual affairs. So that means that when the sexual and romantic factor comes into this, then we have some trouble, and I won't expand any more on that. I may be using extramarital affairs just in terms of the economy of words to move along tonight. The format that I'd like to follow in my few minutes here is to just name the problem a little bit and then talk about four Mormon myths around extramarital affairs that women are involved in, and then a couple of words about resolutions to those. In terms of the problem, as Mary Beth said, we really don't discuss sexuality very much, and we really don't discuss women reaching out from their marriages to have sexual affairs with somebody else. In a wonderful article in Exponent in 1982 called Mormons and Sexuality, with the focus a lot on women, there was not one mention of extramarital sexual affairs. I think it's interesting that we really don't talk about this very much, and that's because it doesn't exist, right? More married men than women do have affairs. And you ask how that can be. Aren't there two people involved in the sexual relationship? And it's because more married men are involved with single women as well as married women than are married women. In other words, married women tend to be involved with married men more than they do single men. Now, what I'm talking about here tonight are just really generalizations. There are as many exceptions as there are people in this room, and so I'm really going to be talking about generalities, and please try and keep that in mind. It seems to be increasing for women to reach out and have these affairs. I don't know quite why. I think that we can speculate that women are perhaps more assertive now than they used to be. I think that women are acting more on their sexuality. They're more sexually liberated. And I think that in religious values, within a religious value system or a traditional lifestyle, that's happening more and more than it used to. There's a new study coming out that you might be interested in. It will be reported in Women's Day magazine in the October issue. I don't have a lot of details on the number of population, but I understand that it's quite extensive. And that study said that 30% of the women have had or are having extramarital affairs. So there's another statistic to throw at you. Not sure where Mormon women fit in. We can speculate it might be close or slightly lower, but we don't know for sure. If we were to take a more broad sample than we did on the study that Frieda was talking about, I think that the numbers would go up among LDS women. Even though the figures might be the same, I think that we'd be dealing with some factors that we'll discuss later, and one of them, of course, is guilt, and one of them is less tolerance about each other, excommunication, things like that. It's not that people who are not LDS don't feel guilt, but we have our own brand, I believe. In the field of therapy, we refer to relationships as a dance, and sometimes when we're doing a diagnosis and et cetera, and it helps to explain why a woman who was raised in an alcoholic home may marry an alcoholic or a potential alcoholic. We know our dance steps, our behaviors, our feelings, and we find someone who knows the complementary steps, who can follow us or whom we can follow, and etc. Extramarital affairs are no exception. They're like a dance. One woman explained her relationship and the difference between the LDS dance and other dances in her extramarital sexual affair. And with her permission, I'd like to give you that description of her LDS experience. She said that her affair was more like a ward dance, slow and steady, unlike a disco. Well-planned encounters, not much spontaneity. Emphasis on decorations. She likened that to the outer facade, the double lifestyle that she had to live, and to emphasize that. As a budget or fundraiser, she says it's not without price, and the price is very high, guilt, excommunication, etc., and never on Sunday. Myth number one. LDS women lose their sense of self-worth and purpose when involved in extramarital sexual affairs. I can't tell you how many women have told me this, just as though they got together and practiced it. I have never felt better about myself, but never felt more guilt. I'm not sorry. In other words, they seem to, so many of them, not everybody, of course, again, seems to feel guilt but not remorse. Again, the Women's Day study that I referred to, of the 30% that were involved, 41% said that it was wrong but that they were not sorry. Most see their affair as different, special, a special kind of loving relationship, and not just somebody they pick up on the street. Unfortunately, others in the LDS culture don't see it that way. The culture, of course, is not very accepting. And so these women tend to pick up some self-worth, even though we don't believe that's the case. It's a different kind of self-worth. They may juggle between increase and decrease in different kinds. Again, we don't have time to go into that. But certainly from gain some identity, some acceptance. And acceptance seems to be a stronger motivator than does guilt. They find oftentimes their sexual self. LDS women traditionally are not, as we've already discussed at this point, not really seen as sex symbols. Mark Twain visited the Salt Lake Valley many, many years ago, and maybe you've heard of his quote as he writes back saying that they're anything, those Mormon women are anything but sexy. But it's an attempt to define our sexual self. So the definition I like the best of an extramarital sexual affair is this: the attempt to define oneself in terms of validation and acceptance by another in a sexually intimate relationship. But the attempt to find oneself seems to be the attempt to find one's total self, and they do it through this sexual relationship. Myth number two, the LDS woman engages in extramarital sexual affair because her LDS marriage is sexually unfulfilling to her. Again, in the Women Day study, women do it for romance, and men are more likely to do it for sex. Now, I found that also, and again, no LDS statistics, but that is often the case. Again, there are many, many reasons why women get involved, but very few of them, some, but very few are involved extramaritally because they're not sexually satisfied at home. Women tend to put more emotional significance on relationships than men. And one study, I thought this was interesting, said that women tend to overestimate the importance of an affair and men tend to underestimate. And that, you can see the interaction and what could go on there. Many reasons I mentioned. One is identity, already said. One is another one might be an equalizer, that he's involved in church work, that he's involved in his work, that he makes a living, whatever. But she then has an affair to equalize his affair with church or his affair with work or his affair with another woman. In LDS patriarchal marriages, sometimes we run into the authority and the passive-aggressive behavior, the authority of the male and the passive-aggressive behavior of a woman. And many of them have told me, I just can't tell him that this is what I want and this is what I think and this is what we should do and etc. And so it's sort of a rebellious act. And the ultimate anger, rebellious act of acting out against the family, against the primary unit, and etc., and a way to get back at him. It may involve boredom then, and it may involve oppression. And if you put boredom and oppression together, it turns out to be the situation like the farmer who found out that his wife of 10 years his wife had been involved in an extramarital affair after 10 years, and he says, "I can't understand it. I haven't let her out of the kitchen for 25 years." Which brings us to myth number three. Most husbands know their wives are involved with another. Most do not, it appears to be. We have to define know. Do they suspect? Do they consciously know or subconsciously? But men don't seem to be as attuned into relationships as women. Women more often will go through notebooks and those kinds of things. I think this was interesting, again, in the Women's Day study, that 55% of the women said they would have lunch with a sexually attractive man. Then they asked those husbands, and the husband said no, that their wives would not have lunch with a sexually attractive man. So we're back to the myth of husbands know. We don't know how to handle male-female relationships in the church or outside of the church that are not sexual and romantic. I see us as on a very, very primitive level. I think it's one of the saddest points that we need to face, and that is that we need to learn how to have a relationship between a man and a woman that is not on this end sexually and romantically involved, or on this end so standoffish that we aren't even friendly. The day that we can have a Sunday school presidency and have men and women working together will be the day that I think will be glorious. And some wards have tried that and evidently have gone back and scrapped the whole idea and etc. Myth number four. These women are dependent LDS women who are submissive to patriarchy and are looking for men who will take care of them. Maybe some. If they're looking for older men and etc. But most often I don't see that. I see that most often these women are not weak, but are in fact attracted to weak men. And I don't mean to make that a put down, because again, it doesn't happen all the time. But when you get into the dynamics, they want to help them, they want to change them, they want to feel in control, the kind of control that maybe they haven't felt in their homes before. They're strong, but they oftentimes are into sacrifice. Sacrifice is something we all know very well in our culture. Either they, one, are attracted to a weak, suffering person and want to take care of them and sacrifice to take care of them, or two, they're self-sacrificing, more in touch with his sexuality than hers. Many women have said, just to know that I can turn this a man on like this is wonderful. I can't seem to reach my husband in that kind of way, and etc. So she prides herself in how little she asks of this man outside of the marriage. She's hungry to help, to sacrifice her needs for his. The problem is that hungry people don't make very good shoppers. In conclusion, what is the resolution? It's a painful situation. I can't tell you how much pain is involved with these women. They feel it intensely. They're in a no-win situation, a dead-end situation. Very, very painful. There is hope for them. It's hard work. They need to realize that when they need a fix, a relationship or etc., that something needs fixing. Oftentimes it's resolved when the man breaks up the relationship. Sometimes the women will. Oftentimes it's the man. It's resolved when they get help. Sometimes understanding Bishop, unfortunately, that isn't always the case. A bishop may use it as a bargaining chip. If you go back to your husband, this and this and this may be happen. Support groups aren't there in the church, it seems like. There are some support groups, as we know, for singles. We're trying to get some going for incest victims, but I don't know of any support groups, unless you do, for women who have had extramarital sexual affairs. I'm biased, but of course therapy is a option. Lastly, it's resolved when the core of herself is discovered. The core is not in others. Acceptance of others is secondary, but primary is acceptance of herself. Self-mastery is increased, and identity is no longer primarily defined from other relationships. The ability to discern when something is not good for oneself, to trust one's feelings, is resolved when a decision is made not to be used by another. Not always is the case, but oftentimes they are. And most of all, it's resolved when suffering is no longer the ticket to acceptance. Self-acceptance, acceptance by a man, or acceptance by God. Thank you.
I was talking to a friend today and who asked me what I was doing tonight, and I said I was going to speak as part of a panel on Mormon women and sexuality, and she said, "Ha, isn't that a contradiction in terms?" So I said, "Well, you better come and see." I want to talk to you about Jan. Jan is a delightful woman. I think you'd like her. She's about 2 years older than I am, so quite young, actually. She was 2 years ahead of me in school growing up. She's one of those girls that just shines. You know, she was noticeable all the time, friendly and outgoing and fun, kind of in the center of things. One of the things that amazed me about her is that her hair was always perfect. She had this blonde, shiny, bouncy hair, and it was always perfect. She didn't seem to spend any time on it, though, because she was always very busy. She was very active in school plays. She had a wonderful sense of humor. She was the initiator of all the fun stuff. She was my brother's age, and they used to play tennis as we got older into junior high and high school. And they were both very good. And in fact, Jan was so good that sometimes it was amazing to me she would beat my brother. And when I was mad at him, I loved her for that. I always thought that he had sort of a crush on her, even though he had a steady girlfriend. And it really wouldn't have mattered because she always, always, always went with Joe. And Joe was a wonderful guy. He was president of our junior high school and president of our high school, Sterling Scholar, an athlete. And together they were the kind of young couple that just really seemed to generate fun. They knew how to have fun together, and it was always fun to be around them. They went up to the university after high school, and not long after that, Joe went on a mission. Jan continued in school. She was a very good student. She worked part-time. She was active in a sorority. She continued to play tennis. Joe came back from his mission. The assumption was they'd probably get married, but they didn't. And a little while after that, Joe started dating a girl that was in Jan's sorority. They dated for about a year, got married, had five kids, had a good relationship. And back then, Jan finished college, and then she went on a mission. She loved her mission. She was an excellent missionary. She came back home. We said, well, surely now she'll get married. She went off to law school in Washington, D.C., and we heard that finally she did get married to a fellow student. And although he wasn't LDS, he supported her activity in the church. They had two children. They practiced law, not the children. Jan and her husband. And they were married for about 8 years and then got a divorce. Jan returned to Salt Lake with her children. She continued to practice law. She raised her kids. She taught Relief Society. She continued to play tennis. She got active in Utahns for Peace. And I became reacquainted with her. And we began to play tennis, and she beat me far more regularly than she did my brother. And we would talk, and one day I asked her if she had been interested at all in remarrying. And to my surprise, her eyes filled with tears, and she was unable to respond for a couple of minutes. And finally, she said there was a really excellent person a couple of years ago that she had met, become friends with, fallen in love with, a single parent like her, a professional person like her, very active in the church, a fun, kind, and loving person. Although I could tell there was a problem, I wondered what it was. She said the problem was this other excellent person was a woman. They struggled with their feelings. They worked together and separately, trying to understand what was happening to them. They denied their feelings. They saw each other. They didn't see each other. They didn't want to leave the church. They didn't want to leave the love, companionship, respect, regard that they shared in their relationship. While this is a true story, Jan's name is not Jan. I am not the friend, but I know the friend. About a quarter of my clients in my private practice have stories similar to Jan's. And about 12% of our members in the church have stories similar to Jan's. Jan could be your daughter. She could be your sister. She could be your friend. She could be your mom. Jan could be you. The most important part of Jan has not changed. Her history has not been negated or eliminated because of her feelings for this woman, who we shall call Barbara. Her own testimony of the efficacy of Christ's life and the impact of his life on hers has not changed. Jan's sexual feelings also have not changed. She began struggling with the differences she experienced in her sexuality from what she had been taught to expect, almost from puberty. She was confused and frightened and repressed her feelings for years. When they surfaced, she felt bad, immoral, and deviant. She worried about herself and questioned her goodness. She kept busy, very, very busy.
This is the end of this cassette. Please go to the next cassette for the continuation of the program material. We now continue with Mormon women's sexuality.
Felt guilty and dishonest, and got a divorce, and felt honest and authentic and isolated. Jan's life experience, her beliefs, her emotions are still real and true. What I find in my clients who have stories similar to Jan's is that they are caught in a painful and heart-wrenching dilemma. If they are to acknowledge and accept the truth of their sexuality, that they are not attracted to, and perhaps even put off by the idea of sexual relationship with a man, not through choice, but through circumstance, either biological or situational, then they must deny the truth of their own spirituality, their own spiritual reality. On the other hand, if they make the choice to express themselves spiritually according to current church standards and expectations, they must deny, reject, and condemn the truth of their own sexuality. They are caught in a spiritual, emotional, and psychological dilemma that fragments the personality, abolishes authenticity and personal honesty, and denies healthy emotional and spiritual growth. The self is denied truth. My clients are not asking for quick fixes, for pop psych rhetoric, or for permission. They want self-understanding, self-acceptance, and congruency between their own truth and the gospel of Jesus Christ. They want the continued love and support of their family, their friends, and their church. They want adult, sexual, emotional, and spiritual love. They want companionship. They want personal integrity, self-regard, and the understanding and acceptance to any person of worth. Their questions to me are thoughtful expressions of immense concern for themselves and the people they care for. Typical client questions are these: if I acknowledge the feelings I have inside of me for a female companion, must I deny the feelings I have that are equally real and equally important for the gospel of Jesus Christ? Can I be spiritual and homosexual? If I accept my sexuality, will my Heavenly Father accept me? If I deny or repress these feelings, must I live without adult love and companionship for my entire life? How do I do that? Will these feelings go away once I move from this life to the next? How do I live a lie? When it seems that the advice of my leaders conflicts with my own conscience, what process leads me to truth? Where is the onus of responsibility for my decision? Within me or with my leaders? I think about these women, questioning whether they have a right to our Heavenly Father's love, to the love of the members and leaders of the church, if they are homosexual. And I wonder where we have lost Christ's message. A statement made by Gordon B. Hinckley skips across my mind. He said, "The principle of love is the foundation of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Without love, there is little to commend the church to us as a way of life." I think about the therapeutic process that will hopefully return or invite self-worth for these women. And I begin with these therapeutic premises. Happiness cannot coexist with self-deception. One must first look for the truth within, then we can decide what to do with that truth. This person matters more than rules. Self-esteem matters more than approval. Growth matters more than security. I need you to know also that for my Mormon clients, it is impossible to separate out the spiritual issues from the psychological issues. We then begin with a therapeutic process. We say, if you have these sexual feelings for members of your own gender, then we acknowledge that that is true for her. If she does not have those feelings, but someone significant wants her to have them, then she doesn't. She must accept that as her truth. They must be responsible only to themselves. If she does have sexual feelings for members of her own gender, then we acknowledge she can be a good person and have these feelings. We accept that feelings are. They are neither good nor bad. They simply reflect her reality. We acknowledge that feelings don't get to be king. They don't get to run the planet. They don't rule our lives. We manage our feelings. What I feel is one matter. How I behave is another matter altogether. There is no feeling for which I need feel guilty. I may not choose my feelings, but I can choose my behavior. And we say, you have these feelings. They are part of you. Now what do you want to do with them? You have some choices. If you choose to act on these feelings, what are the likely consequences to you and to others? Remember, the consequence to you is your responsibility. The consequence to others may be your concern, but it is not your responsibility. You may care very deeply what others want for you, but if you make major life choices based on other people's needs, you live their lives, not your own. Most importantly, you must live with yourself. Can you express the homosexual feelings you have and live congruently with your own values? Underline own. My client may ask, if I choose to act on these feelings, even if I have a relationship with a woman that is marked by loving, committed behavior, with fidelity and integrity, with kindness and consideration, with joyfulness and laughter, with honesty, will my heavenly parents embrace me at the doors of the kingdom and welcome me and honor me for a life well lived? Can I give these clients an answer to that question? No. Can any other human being on this planet? I think not. Can they? I believe the onus of responsibility is within them. It lives in there. Their growth is their own responsibility. We are here, I believe, not to be tested but to learn. I do not believe that this life is a testing center. I believe this life is a classroom. It is a place for us to learn. I believe that Christ's life was an example for us to use. I believe it is our responsibility to experience life, to do that very carefully, very joyfully, engaged fully in the process of learning. I believe it is important for us to have the opportunity to try to learn and to grow. I also believe that we have a right to love and enjoy the process of growth called life, to learn as we go, never condemning ourselves or others, because we are in a process. I believe that when we forsake the responsibility of the development of our own personal value system to the expected requirements of a reference group around us, it results in spiritual impoverishment and limited growth. So, one choice is to allow yourself to discover whether living in a homosexual relationship can allow you to grow emotionally, intellectually, and spiritually. It requires great strength and great honesty. You must never compromise what is necessary for your own integrity. I believe that Christ's life is a perfect model. I believe Christ's life was replete with exceptions. It seems to me his constant commitment was not to rules but to relationships, and to the deepest welfare of each individual. His message to me was that morality must not stand in opposition to the gospel, that what he wants for us is fulfillment that comes through a moral system that not necessarily seeks approval through convention, that is not, it is not other-directed, subordinating one's own values to the expectations of the community you find yourself in, but rather a moral system that is inner-directed, using our own conscience and claiming direct access to our Heavenly Father. Then these women will either discover that life is good or life is not. It has validity and worth, or it is compromised and fragmented. Then, if life is a true process of learning and growing and personal responsibility, hopefully you will use your experience to make decisions resulting in increased congruency between what you believe is right and how you act. The answer is within each one of us. You may choose to live in a homosexual relationship because it allows for the fullest expression of who you are and for your fullest growth. You can include the gospel in your life completely, and you can include the church in your life to the extent that it is possible. Or you may choose not to live in a homosexual relationship. You can include the gospel in your life completely and the church in your life completely, and you can find companionship and love in many other ways. Either way, there will be losses and gains. Only you can decide what authentic living is for you. First of all, you must think well of yourself, and if your journey is sincere and honest and considerate of yourself and others, I believe you will have lived a life well lived. And if the therapeutic process is complete and good, the Jans and Barbaras among us will respect and honor themselves and their lives and believe in their worth. And I sincerely hope that the love that is within us will honor the love that is within them. Thanks.
We'd like to have questions and hopefully provide some answers over the next 15 to 20 minutes, and we'd be glad to go beyond that for another 15 minutes or so if you would like to. We request that you address one of the panel members and succinctly state your question. If you want to make a statement instead of asking a question, please do that in one or two sentences. Okay, the question is to address the good girl, bad girl situation. Her husband wanted, not was yours, somebody else anyway, wanted to marry someone, a bad girl he could take to the temple. I mean, somebody could, bad girl in bed, but could take to the temple. Some people in the secular world call that the Madonna whore split, And I think it is because we do split our sexuality and spirituality, and if we rearrange that cognitively in our head so that we see that however you are in bed with your husband is mutually consenting, that that is something you're both agreeing to, enjoying, and that is spiritually okay also, then you don't have to split that off one way or the other. I also don't think, I guess it would be terribly bad to maybe have sexual fantasies in the temple. I mean, I would, you know, you could take it in both directions. So I think it's a construction that we bring to the situation, and I my sense is that really more men have had that than women. I don't hear women talking about that as much as men. Am I wrong about that? Anyone? Okay. Next question? Yes.
I'm not sure. I don't understand the concept social desirability.
Are they answering the way they should answer?
No, I think it's just a skewed population because we had a very limited amount of time to try and get a group of LDS women to respond to the questionnaire. So they were a particular subculture within the LDS culture. As we now have more time because we wanted to present this data to the symposium tonight, as we have more time to continue to collect the data, I think it's going to even out. I think on the whole these women are highly sexual, very devoted to their relationships, in very positive, loving, strong marriages. And I think as we get more of women responding, that's going to probably even out, unfortunately, on the downside, but I believe that will be the reality.
Okay, next question? Yes. Anne?
I think it's true to a point. I think there would be, we all see the world through our own eyes. And so I think that absolutely there would be differences, but I don't know that I would think that they would be as divergent as you imply.
Next question.
Okay,
the question is, there is asking Debbie if there is a power in our own sexuality, and ask her to comment.
Oh, I was talking more about the powerlessness that victims feel as a whole, and that many of us as women feel as Mormon women who are in an institution where the power, the hierarchy, is with men. And a dilemma to that is similar to what I think Barbara expressed, that the courts are held by men and women are trying to be heard and trying to be understood. The same is true of sexually abused women. They go to their bishops for advice and counsel. Can a man truly understand a female's experience of being sexually abused? Is that possible? It's my belief that we are that denial of institutional power makes it very important for us to experience personal power in our lives, to be able to experience our autonomy as individuals, to be able to make decisions according to our life, make our decisions about our life and be very firm in that. As far as the anger, I didn't state that anger was inappropriate, but that we tell women as a church, and we tell our people that anger is inappropriate, try not to experience it, that it's an evil or wicked or bad feeling. And we deny the experience that these women have, that they need to have to heal, which is being able to be angry. And that being able to be angry, I had a patient state it to me that was a statement that when I first began to feel angry, that was the statement that I'm worth being angry about, which was a powerful statement to be able to make. I don't know.
I guess I'm understanding everything you're saying, and I did understand at the time. I'm trying to move into a, so now what do I do? If there is such a power in being not sexually aware necessarily in terms of being pregnant, but totally aware and sexuality being a part of that awareness, Give me a step one.
Okay, the question is, see if I can see it. The question is, if I accept my feelings and I accept my sexuality, then what power does it create in my life? Is that the question?
Is that the question?
Or how do you exercise that power? Thank you very much. I mean, now, okay, let's say now you acknowledge it. So move me into an action. How do I then express that as a power within me?
Oh, okay.
I am not active.
I can give you personal examples of my experience with that, and that's the best I can do. I work for IHC. I hope nobody here works for IHC, but it's a difficult corporation to work for sometimes. And I was sitting in a psychologist meeting a few weeks ago, and the rules were coming down. And the rules were... they wanted a therapist to put in something close to 40 hours a week of therapy, which was incapable. That's just incomprehensible. So I walked out of the meeting just angry and frustrated. Now, that was my situation dealing with the institution. And with my anger, I said to myself, I am really angry. I do not have power to change that institution. It's huge. Where is my power? And what I came to grips with, my power is that I will agree to work this many hours a week, do this many hours of therapy. If they like it, they can have me as an employee. If they don't like it, then I have other options. I did have other options. I think oftentimes in relation to the church even, we fail to see that we have power in where we choose to stand with that. That is our personal power. That takes a lot of examining to come to grips with where that personal power is. But we do have options, and we do have choices, and we do have the autonomy to make those. They have consequences to them, but we still have the options. I don't know. Did that explain it?
I have an example from a friend of mine about using that sense of self when it's integrated. When your sexual sense of self is integrated, how it's powerful. She said that when she felt like she was, when she felt like God made up all the rules about what she could do and not do, thanks Lou, then whenever she would become sexually involved, this is when she was single, in terms of kissing or making out or whatever, she would appeal to the rules to make the decision for her about what she should do and not do. But when she saw herself as making the decision because it felt good, didn't feel good, felt congruent with herself, then she had to get tougher with herself and tell whoever she was with that she liked this, didn't like this, wanted to do it, didn't want to do it, based on her feeling. And that once she had a sense of herself, she could do that before she could not do it. So that may be addressing your question. The next question? Over here.
Well, not so much action, of course, as part of the church board, but what I've heard of
the church in Canada said to us, saying, if you are going to remain a member of the church, you need to get this kind of counseling, you need to get this kind of therapy. And so far, they have not done anything like that. The local leaders are again just saying, let's not talk about it up to this point. And I'm wondering, what is the common, if you can say it's a common occurrence, what would be the type of things that would occur in something like this?
Could you repeat that?
Is there anyone who didn't hear the question? Okay.
Should I just answer?
Yes.
Okay. What's happening right now, the church policy at this point in time, if there is one, and interestingly, it seems to be somewhat fluid at this point in time, which gives me great hope, is that if a woman is not acting on her homosexual feelings, and I'm not clear whether this woman was or not.
She goes in and out of that. This is the double life.
Okay.
There's a time when she just can't express it anymore. She can't express it anymore. Double life to
long
initials. She's always been kind of the model of a Mormon woman.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The church seems to sing at this point in time, if you'll just cut that out, stop doing that, then there are a couple of things that seem to happen, disfellowship but not excommunication or not disfellowship, and a commitment to not participate in sexual activity with women and to live a life of celibacy or to get back into the marriage and try that again. If she is actively involved in a homosexual relationship, then from what I'm hearing from clients and talking to people involved with church policy is that she would be excommunicated. There is also precedent in the state of Utah that for rights of custody, that will not be the singular issue. They will not deprive a mother of her children because of that issue only. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Oh, wait a minute. I think there was another question back over here. I can't remember. In the white dress, and then we'll come here. Question briefly is, do women who are working in close proximity with men become more at risk for having an extramarital affair?
No statistics on that, but if you ask the farmer, he would have an answer for you. You can stay home, in other words, and have an affair, and you don't need to go out. I think in terms of the overall, quote, issue, the thing that I didn't say is that state of affairs that happens, that we can't seem to have male and female friends very easily, is not really a statement on the church authorities alone. It's not really a statement on us that we can't handle it. I think it's a very complicated matter, and I think we all have a part in that. I think that we can't turn to the church authorities and say, they don't trust me. I think that there are reasons why they don't. I think that when I said it's a primitive, we're at a primitive stage, we all are. I think the organization is, I think culture is, and I think we are as individuals. We have to learn how to live and have relationships and friendships with people of the other sex. So we cannot place the blame any one place.
The question is, the person understood the statistic is 12% in the church are lesbian. Do you have any statistics on how many men are homosexual?
You know, that's a combined population. I didn't split that out.
Well, obviously,
yes.
A lot of you heard that.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
That, and if you have 3.5 days, I could give you a more complete answer. But I really do mean that. Yes, I think there are lots of ways to get gay, to get homosexual. There is increasing body of evidence that there is something happening in utero. Occasionally, where hormones are involved at a certain point in the fetal development, and that can be a factor. There is a body of research that indicates that there can be, between birth and the age of 3 years old, a sexual identification with the opposite gendered parent, taking my sexual identification from the opposite gendered parent, creating a switch or a shift in sexual identity. There's a body of information that indicates that it can be caused by crisis. Debbie indicated problems with sexual identity for young women who have been raped or molested. That occurs. Some women, my sense is maybe more so than men, do choose homosexuality. It's a political, social, spiritual, ethical decision for them. So lots of reasons.
Thanks. Questions? About 3 questions over here.
Kind of related to that, Kenzie, I believe, used a scale of 1 to 10 or something anyway, a scale which he rated people either totally heterosexual, totally homosexual, or, as I recall, most people falling somewhere in between where they had the capacity for, in varying degrees. Is that still considered good psychology?
Oh, I don't know. But, there's also a theory that human beings were created bisexual. And that it is and that we all have that capacity, and that it is only our socialization that deprives us of the choice, and that is considered one of the existing theories. People get socialized out of being bisexual, but what we do know is that there are many people in our society who do have the capacity to make emotional and sexual attachments and bonds with persons, regardless of gender, and that gender is not the issue for some people.
Next question, right here in the front row.
We've been talking about anger, and I don't even know who to address this to, anybody who wants to answer. I'm curious about Mormon women and having hysterectomies and how all of that relates. I remember looking back about 5 years ago in my neighborhood in Pleasant Grove, Utah, every woman my age had a hysterectomy. And shortly thereafter, they all work and they do all these great things that, you know, that they wanted to do. And I think it's my feeling that there's tremendous rage in women in the church, and that many of them are denying their sexuality. And I just want to know if someone wants to comment about that.
Well, they obviously don't. I don't know, I may be suspect. I had a hysterectomy last November.
I went through a ton of that kind of thing. And as I look back at it and have healed some things for myself and see what these other women are doing, that's my question.
Mary Beth, could I clarify something? I'm not sure of the connection between the hysterectomy and anger.
We're living in a time now when medicine is saying so much more about what we do with our mind and how it affects our bodies, for instance. So if we literally do not want to say to our husbands how we feel about things, I personally think I shut myself right off subconsciously on the sexual level. Period. And I think it's something we need to look at. I would love to know what the statistics are. I think it's acceptable for Mormon women to have medical problems rather than to be angry and to express what they're really feeling.
Well, I think that's true for American women and Western women in general, too. I don't think it's just a Mormon issue. And I would say that probably all three things have, I mean, the issue about hysterectomy is an issue about anger and feelings and somaticizes, and then are not always linked, nor are they always separate, that there would be at least three categories, ones where hysterectomies have nothing to do with anger and feelings, probably a large category where, in fact, it does, and then some where there are feelings and it, in fact, doesn't affect your reproductive system. So I don't know of any research, any information. I know some people talk about it and as being a real possibility, but I would sense that your own personal discovery about what that issue for you and how it's connected would be the best field of research unless you wanted to send out questionnaires.
I know of a research study that was done in a Lutheran community in North Dakota by an obstetrician who later became a psychiatrist. And these women were in a community where birth control was absolutely forbidden. It was just the worst thing you could do. This was 35 years ago, by the way. And the average hysterectomy was at 36. Because the only acceptable way for a person to stop having children was if you had something wrong with you. And the conclusion was that they were able to make their bodies do what they wanted them to do, and they couldn't find any help anywhere else.
Could you in the back hear that comment? No, because essentially the remark is on a study for women 35 years ago in a Lutheran community who did not have birth control available to them, sanctioned available to them, that a large percentage had hysterectomies, and the average age was 36. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
I'd like to make perhaps a few disjointed comments because I think it's a very complex issue. First, to start, there is, and I will suggest that we all watch on Monday nights at 9 o'clock. John Bradshaw on The Family is on returning on a series of TV. According to him, and I will quote, "Our anger is our strength." Unquote. And I would just leave that as a thought, not to stamp around and beat up people, but to acknowledge our feeling of anger is a source of our strength. How anger and hysterectomies are related is another issue, but I think there's something important we have to bring into this. The five most performed surgeries in these United States of America are on the female reproductive system. And you have to realize that this is generally adult females, and so that's less than half the population when you bring in children and men, etc. And yet, the five top surgeries performed are on the female reproductive system. Now, some of it may be due to what you are expressing, which is that when women have no other alternatives, they may express their anger at their femininity and their reproductive system and say, I'll be darned if I'm going to have any more children, and this is a way to take care of it. However, the medical profession is dominated by males, and they make a great deal of money on the female reproductive system.
And I think that that has to be taken into consideration when you're looking at the surgery of hysterectomy. It is probably the most overperformed surgery that exists, and maybe if there's a few doctors in the audience, perhaps they would attest to that.
We have time for one more question. I think, you, Ardeen, you've had your hand up for a long time.
I was surprised that no one commented directly on the impact of sex education as practiced in the MIAs, young women's organizations, and so on the problems that you have been discussing.
What's sex education?
That was part of mine that got cut out according to time, but that is a problem when young women who, with my group that I was speaking about sexually abused but totally, are told that they are responsible for sexual activities, that how they dress and how they act is more important, and it is necessary for us to, I think that's changed a lot over the years too. I think we do that better now than we used to do that. But I think we need to continue to become aware that males and females are equally responsible for sexual activity, and we need to make sure that that is taught rather than the other. The other enforces the guilt that is unneeded when we tell women that they are the ones singularly responsible.
Although in this year's Relief Society lesson on, you know, the body is a temple lesson, I don't know what it's called this year, but there's a specific statement that you're to teach your children to regard their body highly and to teach your girls to dress modestly. There's no statement about teaching males to dress modestly. And as you've noticed on male pinup calendars, they're becoming more sexual all the time. Thank you for your response and your listening ear and for your questions. We've appreciated this evening. Connie Disney will give our closing prayer.
Father in heaven, we deeply appreciate being here this evening. We're thankful for these women and their participation on the panel, for their wisdom and their sensitivity, and their willingness to share with us. We ask thee to bless us in our struggles with these issues and in our efforts to identify the things that are true for each of us. We ask thee to bless us as a community in our continued efforts for harmony and joy and peace in our lives. And we say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
This is the end of this cassette.